Okay, sign and sheet will be going around in just a little bit. This is the last week of class, so we have class today and on Wednesday. And then your final is probably, what, a week from today? Is that right? I don't have the schedule. Oh, I do have the schedule right here. May 23rd, exam 5. Yeah, so it's going to start with blood vessels, lymphatic, respiratory, digestive, urinary, and reproductive systems. Okay, don't forget, I got the chapter numbers wrong on the schedule right here, so make sure you study those chapters. And also, in the back of the book, they must have renumbered the chapters. The answers to the end of chapter questions are not, they're in the appendix, but they're not by the correct chapter number. So I think the answers to chapter 19 are in 18. The answers to 20 are in 19. All right, so just don't memorize those answers as you see them in the back of the book. Make sure that they match up correctly with the questions. All right, so this is May 16th. We're going to start the first lecture on reproductive system today. But does anybody have any questions on anything? Okay, your practicum, your last practicum is this week, and the Monday class gets two quizzes. They get lab quiz number 10, and then they get the extra quiz. All right, the Wednesday class gets a practicum and then lab quiz 10 after the practicum because you already have taken the extra quiz. All right, so, before we get started talking about the reproductive system, I do have a little note right here. Is anybody aware of the safe haven laws in California? What the heck is that all about? Well, it started in a really conservative state, Texas, back in 1999. And the safe haven laws just says that if you have a baby, you're not obligated to take care of that baby. If you surrender that baby within 24 hours, depending on the county, maybe 48 hours to a police station or an emergency room or a fire station, then you no longer have any obligations to raise that young person. Okay? And does anybody know why people decided to pass that law? Because, unfortunately, some people get really stressed out when they have a baby, and as soon as they have it, okay, they murder the baby. And there's a lot of babies that are found in dumpsters across the nation. I know there was a student up at USC not too long ago that was accused of just doing that. And so instead of just getting rid of that little baby, you can surrender it, and then it will go up for adoption. All right, so everybody should be aware of that safe haven law. Not that any of you would do that, but pass the word around, right? That might save somebody's life one of these days. Okay, so let's start talking about the male reproductive system first. All right, so here we have the male reproductive system, nice sagittal section. And the primary reproductive structure right here is the testes. And notice where the testes is. It's not in the pelvic cavity, like the primary reproductive organ for the female is. It's located outside the pelvic cavity in a structure we call the scrotum. And in lab we talked about, why is this testis down in the scrotum? Does anybody remember why is this testes over here not in the body cavity? Well, it keeps it cooler because the process of making male gametes, a male gamete is sperm, requires a lower than normal body temperature. So the testes is cooler in this particular location. And then spermatogenesis can take place naturally. But there is another real important reason. Testes will descend during gestation from the pelvic cavity into the scrotum so that when a male is born, the testes is already in the scrotum over here, right? And every physician is going to check to see that there are how many in the scrotum here when you're born, if you're a male? Two, right? There should be two. Because if there is an undescended testicle in the pelvic cavity, all right, not only will it not be able to produce sperm, but it will turn cancerous, all right, if it's at body temperature. So it's a fairly dangerous situation, and then if it doesn't descend, then it has to be removed surgically. So even if you raise cats or dogs or horses or any other kind of mammal, everybody knows to check if it's a male that both testes have descended into the scrotum. If not, then even that animal will succumb to testicular cancer at an early age, right? And it has to be removed. All right, so the function of the testes right here is twofold. It produces a male gamete, which is the male sex cell, and that is a sperm. And A sperm is the only cell in the human body that is motile, that can freely swim around, because what kind of organelle does it have that allows it to swim around? In an aqueous environment, it is as close to cilia, but there's another organelle that is important for motility, and that is a flagellum, right? So it would be possible. There are many cells, free living organisms that are unicellular that do swim around by cilia, but there are just as many that swim around by flagella, and the human cell, the human sperm, has a flagellum. So the testes, one function of the testes is to produce sperm, the other is to produce the male sex hormone. And there is only one, it's a steroid, and it is testosterone. There might be some related compounds, but they're all, we can just call them all testosterone. Okay, and that's a hormone that gets picked up by the cardiovascular system and delivered everywhere in the body. All right, so the testes has to have a testicular artery and testicular nerve, and we're going to see where that is in just a little bit. Okay, there's a place after the testes produces sperm where they go to mature before they can freely swim around, and that is a bunch of coiled tubes on the outside of the testes right here, which is called the epididymis. So sperm start in tubes in the testicle and then move into the epididymis, and they're stored until what time? Until it's time to go. What do we call that? Ejaculation. That's right. So when ejaculation happens, then the sperm, because of peristalsis, move into the vas deferens, and then by peristalsis they get pushed back up into the body cavity through the inguinal canal right here that pierces the body wall. And then the vas deferens, sometimes we call this the ductus deferens. Vas deferens and ductus deferens are exactly the same. Goes over, starting here at the anterior part of the bladder, over the superior part, courses inferiorly, and then goes back inferiorly behind the urinary bladder, where it joins up with another gland. And this gland doesn't produce hormones, but it does add volume to the ejaculate. And these are called the seminal vesicles. You have two of these, if you're male, bilaterally. Okay? And the seminal vesicle adds maybe about 60% of the volume of ejaculate. So there are a number of things in the seminal vesicle, fluid. Okay, I think I maybe have a list right here someplace. Okay, so there are nutrients for sperm motility. There are agents that neutralize the acidic environment of the male urethra and the female vagina. There are agents that cause the ejaculate to coagulate once in the vagina so that it doesn't run out, so that fertilization can take place. And then after a certain time, that plug slowly liquefies to release sperm. So there are also liquefying agents in these volumes that are added to the ejaculate as it passes through the seminal vesicle. Okay, and then the vas deferens turns into the ejaculatory duct as it enters a second gland right here, just inferior to the urinary bladder, and that's the prostate. And again, it adds volume to the ejaculate, and it's basically those same kinds of agents that we were talking about. Okay, so, but the volume from the prostate is only about 30%, right? So now we're what, at 90%? So only 10% really is of spermatozoa from the testes. Okay, then notice, here is the urinary bladder, and here is a ureter bringing urine from a kidney to the urinary bladder. That exits the urinary bladder in its inferior margin right here, courses through the prostate gland. And so what is this tube that takes urine to the outside world from the urinary bladder? That is the urethra. And here we see that the male reproductive tract and the urinary tract form one tract. The ejaculatory duct then joins with the urethra in the division of the urethra that we call the prostatic urethra because it's on the inside of the prostate, and then it follows the urethra to the outside world, and here is the external urethral orifice. We got a couple other divisions of the urethra. This right here, as it goes through the perineum or the floor of the pelvic cavity, there are muscles right here. We call this the membranous urethra. And these muscles can also act as a voluntary sphincter that can occlude the passage of urine from the urinary bladder to the outside world, because these are all skeletal muscles right here. There is a smooth muscle that's under autonomic control, and that is up over here by the urinary bladder. And that's going to be the internal urethral sphincter. This is what we call the external urethral sphincter. All right, and the urethra, as it passes through the penis, sometimes we call that the spongy urethra or penile urethra, because the part of the penis that the urethra actually goes through is called the corpus spongiosum. And it kind of looks like a sponge right here because it can fill up with blood. When smooth muscles relax and let blood flow into this part of the penis, right, all these sinuses fill up with blood, and that causes an erection. At the same time, the other erectile tissue in the penis, this is what we call the corpus cavernosum right here. This is on the dorsal side of the penis. The spongiosum is on the ventral side. That also fills up with blood, so that is also erectile tissue. All right, so you got the spongy urethra going all the way through the part of the spongy urethra that we call the glans penis right here. All right, then it's in the outside world. There's one other gland. There's maybe a couple other minor glands as well, but here is the third gland that you should know about, and this is the bulbourethral gland. It doesn't necessarily add much volume to the ejaculate, but it secretes substances even before ejaculation, and its job is to secrete mucus. And mucus is a protein, and of course that is an important lubricant, but it also performs another function. Since it's a protein, it can act as a buffer for acidity. All proteins act as buffers. They neutralize acids. They can neutralize bases, but the male urethra is pretty acidic, and that will immobilize sperm. So this gland right here helps aid in sperm motility as well. And then here's the prepuce over the glans penis, protecting the glans penis right here. And that describes this exam figure pretty well. Okay, let's look at some other parts of the penis. I'm going to flip around just a little bit. Okay, another part of the penis. Oh, here's a pretty good exam figure. Shows a little bit different view of the male reproductive system. All right, so here's the testes and the epididymis. So you should be able to trace sperm from the testes right here all the way to the external urethral orifice in the correct order. So know what tube it starts in. We got to discuss some of the microscopic anatomy of the testes right here. So then eventually gets into the epididymis, the vas deferens. All right, and then there's a little swelling as it passes very close to the seminal vesicles. That's the ampulla of the vas deferens. And then it passes into the ejaculatory duct, and then where? Into the urethra. And the three sections of the urethra are the prostatic urethra, membranous urethra, and spongy urethra right here, right? Then sperm is on its own in the outside world. Okay. All right, so you can see seminal vesicle, prostate, bulbourethral gland. All right, let's look at the penis. So he said that there are basically two kinds of erectile tissues in the penis. And the very center one is the corpus spongiosum. That's the part that the urethra goes through. All right, and that is on the ventral side. The dorsal side of the penis actually has two. And so they kind of look a little bilateral that we see right here. One is called a corpus cavernosum. And plural would be corpora cavernosa, would be the plural for both of those tissues together, if you're going to consider them together. And then, of course, the penis is anchored in up against the body wall with the bulb of the penis of the corpus spongiosum and the crus of the corpora cavernosa right here. Okay, and then is protruding outside of the body, so this is what we call the shaft of the penis and the root of the penis with the crus and bulb. That's internal, so we call that the root of the penis right there. All right, so don't get the corpora cavernosa confused with the corpus spongiosum. And a pretty good question would be, what erectile tissue does the urethra pass through? The corpus spongiosum, right? Exactly right. So as a matter of fact, you could even call that the spongy urethra right there. Okay. All right. Now, we were talking way back when in bones that there was a disease process. And it was a really strange disease process because it's going to affect almost everybody. And it will affect everybody, but some people that have really strong bones aren't affected, right? But it affects everybody, especially women, if you're lucky enough to live old enough. And what is this disease process of bones? Osteoporosis, that's right. When we lose bone mass, our bones get brittle, all right? And this is a strange disease process because there are very few diseases that affect everybody in the population, right? Like right now, if there's a flu going around, would everybody in class get the flu? Absolutely not. Some people will be more resistant than others, right? And some people will come down with it. All right, so there's another strange disease process. It happens specifically with males, if they're lucky enough to live old enough, and it has to do with this prostate gland right here. And that is almost 100% of the male population, if they get into their 80s, maybe late 70s, this prostate will get bigger, and we call that hypertrophy. And as it gets bigger, it's going to occlude this passageway for urine. All right? And so people in that age group have difficulty voiding the urinary bladder when that happens. Now, the terrible thing is that hypertrophy could be due to two reasons. One reason is that the prostate could be growing in a benign fashion, just gets bigger, right? But the second reason is really dangerous because it could be cancerous. It could be a cancerous tumor that is growing, right? And that's one of those two processes is going to affect every male, right, if you're lucky enough to live long enough. And that's a really difficult kind of cancer to detect and diagnose, right? They can take biopsies, but a lot of times the biopsies don't pick up the cancer, right, and then the cancer can grow and go to other parts of the body. So that's a strange process, right, this prostatic hypertrophy, whether it's benign or cancerous, because who's it going to affect in here? Basically every male, if you're lucky enough to live long enough. Now why is that such a strange process? Okay, because it has to do with the basic nature of the reproductive system, right? So I think maybe we should just talk about what is the function of the reproductive system right now. I've asked everybody to think about that, okay? But what is the function of the reproductive system? Yeah, it's to produce diversity in our population, right? It's not just to produce new young human beings running around, right? It's to produce new and unique people. So since we're a diverse population, it's really strange that any kind of process would affect everybody because why? We are all what? We're all different, right? And that makes our population, our species very strong when that happens because of diversity. All right, so that kind of leads me to kind of an interesting kind of thought. Okay, and it shows irony. It's one of my favorite ironies in life. Does anybody know what irony is? Who knows something about irony? Yes, Chris. Give me an example of something that's ironic, or define what irony is.
Well, irony would be something that you're relating to or thinking of a certain thing, and it's exactly what's happening.
Okay. Or how about if it's turning out exactly the opposite, maybe? Yeah, maybe the opposite of what's happening. Like, yeah, exactly the opposite. Like, how about if everybody wants to go to law school, and there's an entrance test to law school, right? So you might think, and this is just a hypothetical case of irony. So you might think, well, get a college education, learn how to read, okay, and you should be able to do pretty well on an entrance test. But what so happens if the people that go to college score worse than people who never went to college that got into law school? Now, that would be what? That would be ironic, right? That would be an irony, okay, because that's something that you wouldn't expect to happen. All right, so here is one of the favorite ironies that I think of, and it has to do with the reproductive system. So what is the purpose of the reproductive system? Is to what? To produce diversity, to produce new and unique individuals. Okay, so here is the irony. The irony is that almost everybody loves sex, right? But hardly anybody really loves diversity. But what's the purpose of the reproductive system? To produce diversity. So I just find that very ironic. Okay? Maybe you see that the same way. Maybe not too. I'm not so sure. Okay. Well, let's continue with the male reproductive system. So we talked about some of these grosser structures right here. All right, but what do we have to go back and talk about? All right, we covered all this. What about the anatomy of the testes? Let's look at some of the microanatomy of the testes right here. Okay, so don't forget the testes are in the scrotum because they have to be cooler. And here are some almost microscopic tubes right here. And these are the tubes that actually produce sperm. And outside of these tubes, there's some interstitial cells that produce testosterone as well. So this is all pretty much where it's happening. These tubes are called seminiferous tubules in this area right here. All right, and so you can see that there are a couple layers of the testes right here. There's this white layer that's like the fibrous capsule of the testes. That's the tunica albuginea. And then on the outside here is the tunica vaginalis. And the albuginea actually invaginates, right? It goes deep into the testes and it forms different lobules within the testes. It separates these seminiferous tubules from each other. All right, when the sperm are ready to move out, they move through this little straight tubule into the Reedy's testes, which is just a plexus, and then the Reedy's testes into the efferent ductules that we see right here. And then finally, they end up in the epididymis. All right, so as it moves through all these different tubules, including the epididymis, right, sperm is maturing. But the epididymis is really the storage place as well as maturation place for sperm. All right, so that's some of the tubes, and you should probably be able to trace a sperm from seminiferous tubule through the straight tubule, Reedy's testis, right, efferent ductules into the epididymis, and then where does it go? It goes into the vas deferens, right? And then past the seminal vesicles, past the ampule, and then into the ejaculatory duct, and then into the urethra. All right, so this testes right here is suspended in the scrotum with a number of things that make up the spermatic cord. And we see some of these things right here, like this red tube. I see a singular red tube. That's a testicular artery that's bringing pretty much warm blood to the testes. So this blood leaving the pelvic cavity is at 98.6 degrees, which is really hot for the testes, right? And that would inhibit spermatogenesis. All right, so that's why this pampiniform plexus of veins surrounds the testicular artery. And this is an interesting heat exchange mechanism because the blood returning to the body is cooler. And so this cooler blood soaks up some of the heat from the testicular artery and cools it down before it gets to the testes. And we also see a nerve plexus, testicular nerve in here, and there's also a muscle called the cremaster muscle. And all of those things make up the spermatic cord. Okay, so you should know spermatic cord. So here's the spermatic cord. You can see the pampiniform plexus, right, and the cremaster muscle, and the different layers of fascia around the testes that actually go up to the inguinal canal right here. So here you can see everything deep to the cremaster muscle is the spermatic cord.
So the spermatic cord function would be
just to suspend the testes, okay, but also to bring nourishment to the testes and innervation to the testes as well. And in that blood supply, of course, that's a way for testosterone to get to the rest of the body. So that blood is a transport mechanism, not just for nutrients arriving at the sperm, but also for signaling compounds like testosterone hormone to get to the rest of the body to produce secondary male sex characteristics. Okay, and do I have that to talk about? Secondary male sex characteristics? Oh, I don't, but maybe I'll talk about that a little bit. Testosterone, okay, makes males a little bit different compared to female sex hormones. Like, for instance, testosterone makes the larynx a little bit bigger, right? So the laryngeal prominence is more observable in males. The larynx is bigger. And what's the effect on the voice then when that happens? Well, it's a deeper voice compared to, right, the rest of the sibs in your family, right? Maybe not necessarily across all people, but typically within a family, males' voices are deeper compared to females. And males have more muscle mass compared to females within the same family. They have stronger bones as a result. And typically males are a little bit taller, okay? And why is that? Oh, that doesn't have to do with testosterone necessarily. That has to do when the primary organ of reproduction becomes activated during puberty. Remember, females reach maturity at an earlier age than males, and when testosterone increases in the blood, that's what closes off the growth plate in bones, the epiphyseal plates. So since females mature at a younger age, they stop growing at a younger age compared to males, at least within a family, right? That's not across the board. Okay. Secondary sex characteristics would be the development of male reproductive organs, like a penis instead of a vagina and uterus and things like that. Okay, and testosterone is also necessary to support spermatogenesis. Okay, so that's some of the functions of the testes. Okay, so the male gamete, or sperm, I guess we have a couple pictures of some sperm. So here's what a sperm looks like. Does not have much in the way of cytoplasm, but it has a flagellum, and it has a nucleus in this part of the sperm, and that nucleus contains genetic material, but it's a very special form of genetic material. It only has half the genetic material that you have in the rest of your body. All right, so I do want you to know what the name of the process is that produces sperm. Okay, so typically we call that spermatogenesis, but we want to know something about the genetic makeup. All right, so here we just have a human body right here. And each of your body, what's your body made of? What's a building block of a living human body? A cell, right? And cells have a nucleus, which contains genetic material, which is the blueprint for how to build this person, but also how the person is going to function on the inside, right? So there are chromosomes inside the nucleus, which contain all of that information. So here we have a human cell with a nucleus in there filled with chromosomes. Does anybody know how many chromosomes are inside this nucleus in most cells in the human body right here? Yeah, there's 46, exactly right. There might be some species that have that same exact number, but there are many other species that have more or less, depending on the species. All right, so there's 46 in particular. All right, but there's a special arrangement of those 46. There's maybe a little bit more precise diagram that we could write on the board. So there's no process in going from this diagram to the next one right here. All right, but I'm going to draw in another nucleus, okay? There are two pairs of chromosomes, right? There are actually two sets of chromosomes. So think of sets, all right? So if we're going to break 46 chromosomes into two sets, what's a really easy way of doing that? Just divide by two, right? So there's going to be actually two sets of 23 chromosomes. So there's one over here, and then two, and then a number three, and they all have a little bit different shape, so you can actually identify chromosomes by their shape, all the way down to number 23. All right, and then there's another set over here, and there's going to be one number one, one number two, one number three, all the way down to, until you get to 23. All right, now why do you have two sets of chromosomes like that? And they're arranged in pairs. Because you have a mom and a dad, right? So one set is going to be the maternal, M is standing for maternal chromosomes. Those you get from your mom, okay? And then this next set over here are going to be the papa chromosomes. That's not the correct scientific term. What would be the correct scientific term? paternal, right? So you get 1 cent from each parent. Okay, so how is it that, so what the heck is a gamete? All right, so a gamete starts, so these are what we call somatic cells. They have two sets of chromosomes. All right, so sometimes we call this 2N or diploid, because there's two sets of chromosomes. All right, so what is the male gamete that is produced again? Sperm. All right, so I'm going to give you kind of a short form here. So here is a sperm, right? And it has a nucleus, but it doesn't have 46 chromosomes. Okay, take a guess. How many chromosomes does it have? It only has 23 in here. All right, and so there's a special process that just randomly takes a number one chromosome. It could be either from the maternal set or the paternal set. It's just kind of a flip of a coin. And then it gets a number two, and again, it's just a flip of a coin to which one it gets, the maternal, a paternal. So there's some arrangement, just random arrangement, of 1, 2, 3, all the way down to number 23 chromosomes right here. Okay? And so every sperm that produced is different than somebody else, just because every time that coin is flipped, it's going to just be some kind of random arrangement, whether you get the maternal or paternal chromosome. All right, so here was a process that we learned about. If we take a normal somatic cell, all right, and it divides, and it produces two cells with 46 chromosomes in it, okay, and it's got 46 here and 46 here. What was the name of this process? And what's the function of this process? This is mitosis, right? So here is mitosis, right? And so this is what we call the parent cell, and these are what we call daughter cells. What's the difference between daughter cells and the parent cell? Absolutely nothing, right? They're just like clones of each other, right? So that doesn't produce diversity. That just produces the same cell over and over and over again. Okay, so that if we were to reproduce new organisms by this mechanism, right, then your children would be, what, exactly like you, and we wouldn't have diversity, and we'd be really susceptible to all kinds of disease processes and probably get wiped out, right, really fast. All right, so that is mitosis. Now, so what is the function of mitosis? There are two. Remember the two functions? What were the two functions? I'm sorry?
Multiply?
Well, that's a math class. Okay. What else? How about growth? Uh-oh. Come on, marker. Growth. All right, to get big, because at one point in time, you were just a single cell. All right, to get big, so you can have fun going to anatomy class and math class, right? Okay, growth is one, but are all the cells that you have right now the ones that you had last year? Absolutely not, because cells die, so that's the second process for mitosis, what is to replace old and damaged cells. All right, so those two functions, but not for reproduction, right? Not for making a new organism. All right, so what is the process, all right, that makes a new organism? That's this thing over here. This is not mitosis, right? Going from two sets of chromosomes, two sets of 23 to one set of 23, this is what we call meiosis. Okay, so with meiosis, you have two rounds of division, both with what? We said IPMAT, so there's what? There is anaphase, metaphase, telophase, right? And so there's two rounds of that to produce this thing right here. So this is a sex cell. What's another name of a sex cell? I used it. Starts with a G. A gamete, right? And a male gamete would be a sperm. A female gamete is going to be an oocyte or an egg. All right. So going from a 2N, how many N's are over here? If we start with a 2N cell, what do we end up with? This is a 1N. It just has one set. Okay, and this is what we call haploid. That's the ploidy of these cells. So the ploidy of a gamete is haploid. The ploidy of a somatic cell is diploid, right? And we're going to tie this all together in just a second. Okay. All right, so that's a gamete. So how do we end up with a new person? We've got to have a female gamete. So that female gamete is what we call, what, an oocyte? And how many chromosomes? What's the ploidy of this oocyte right here? What's the ploidy of an oocyte? Because it's a gamete. Gametes are what? Haploid. How many sets of chromosomes? Just one set, right? 1, 2, 3, all the way down to 23. It just has one set. And then these two sex cells will come together to form this cell right here. Ah, what's this process called? Oh, I should just put that, I shouldn't tell you, I should just put that on the final. What's that process right there? That's fertilization, right? That's fertilization. All right, so now, how many chromosomes do we have in this cell that has formed? You're back to 46, right, which is the correct number. But not just any kind of 46, what do you got? Two sets of 23, all the way down to number 23. 1, 2, 3, all the way down to 23. And so this is what, a 2N cell, or what, diploid? Also has a name, which we're going to get to in just a second. All right, so that process is fertilization, and that cell does have a name. Anybody know what this single cell product of fertilization is called? That is what we call a zygote. All right, so that's a zygote. All right, so then how does a zygote get to be like this? Name the process where a zygote gets to be this person right here. What's that process called? Gestation happens when, yeah, zygote develops into a blastocyst and then that implants into a uterus and then becomes a fetus. Okay, but what's happening to all those cells? As it was a zygote, okay, during gestation, what's the process that turns it into a fetus? And then when it's born, what turns an infant into an adult? What's the name of that process? I read somebody's lips, but you didn't yell it out loud. Yell it out loud. Mitosis. Yeah, because what is mitosis for? It's for growth, to get big, so you can have fun by coming to anatomy class and stuff like that. Okay? So being a zygote wouldn't be much fun. You could never take a practicum. Okay? So meiosis is a nuclear reduction. All right? Mitosis, there's no reduction in chromosomes whatsoever. And so what we just drew on the board right here is what we call the human life cycle. Right? So at some point in your life, half of you was just a sperm and the other half of you was just an egg, and they got together by all kinds of strange processes and made you. Okay. In lab, I asked you how many sexes are there for the human population? There are two. And is that enough? How come there's not three sexes or four? Well, what's the purpose of sex again? Is to produce what? Diversity. And does two sexes produce diversity? Yeah, because everybody's different anyway, right? So you don't need to have three sexes. Two sexes is plenty because of all these different reproductive structures that we have in our body. All right, so nobody really is the same, ever, ever, ever. Okay, but theoretically, is it possible for two parents, if they made you at one time, could they make another you 20 years later or 30 years later? Okay, you know what? If somebody were to flip that coin, all right, a billion times, the chances are that your parents could make another you. All right, it's definitely possible, but it would be so rare for those coins to be flipped in just the right order for you to get the exact same, or for that other person to get the exact same chromosomes as you. It's almost impossible. All right, the odds are astronomical against it. Plus, there are other processes that happen that mix the genes up even more. You're going to have to take like a biology class to learn about that. But yeah, it's possible. Okay, but it's just so, it is so rare that it will probably never ever happen for the life of the universe. Okay, for that to happen, because it's so important to do what? Produce what in a population?
Diversity.
Diversity is so important that it will probably just never ever happen. Okay? Okay. All right, so let's see, what else do we need to talk about in terms of the male reproductive structure right here? You know, that's pretty much about it. This kind of scheme you can think about for the female reproductive structure as well. Okay, just know that. What is the female gamete? That's an egg. What's the ploidy of an egg? What's the ploidy of an egg? That's a strange way of talking, but I want you guys to have that on the tip of your tongue. Well, yeah, what's the ploidy of an oocyte? It is haploid. It has half the number of chromosomes, right? Okay, and that number is, again, just a random arrangement of number one and two. Like this oocyte right here, maybe this number one came from mom, maybe it came from dad, right? You got a 50-50 chance of that happening. Okay, this number 23 is kind of interesting because this is what we call the sex chromosome. And a sex chromosome can be one of two kinds. It can be an X or Y. So number 23, I killed the marker. Number 23, it can be an X or a Y. And if you're a male, okay, you have one X chromosome and one Y chromosome. If you're female, okay, and here's a somatic female. What does a somatic cell have? Two sets of chromosomes, just like most cells in your body. All right, a female will have an X and an X. That's what determines the gender of an individual. Okay, XX. So when a male produces a sperm, remember they only get one chromosome. Half the time it's an X, half the time it's a Y. Okay, and so let's just say here we have a sperm and it's got an X chromosome. Could you think of that as a male sperm or a female sperm? Yeah, because it has the X chromosome. It's kind of a strange way of thinking. And it just so happens that if we have another sperm over here, right, with a Y in it, it just so happens that these sperm are stronger, a little bit stronger, which explains what? There are more females in the population than males. And there's something else really strange about this. All right, the number one chromosome that's maternal and the number one that's paternal, they're exactly the same size and shape, but the X and Y and different. All right, so if we look at an X chromosome, all right, that's what it looks like. If we look at a Y chromosome, it kind of looks like this, and then it has a little piece right there. Here is a Y. So the Y is what? It's a lot smaller. It's missing a lot of genetic material. And we think that this Y chromosome in time is actually getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. What does that lead you to think? It might disappear someday altogether, and then there might not be males. We don't know. It's all just kind of amazing at the moment. But, okay, what this says to me is that males are chromosomally challenged, right? We're missing this material, and all you ladies out there should be sensitive to that, right, and need sensitivity training. Huh. Oh, yeah, we believe they were exactly the same size. Yes, and I don't know in what species or how far back in antiquity you have to go, but it was exactly the same size and is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Yeah, I don't think in our lifetime we can measure how much shorter it gets over the period of, you know, 100 years or something like that. But if we think in terms of thousands or tens of thousands of years, then things like that could happen. But by that point in time, then somebody might be able to figure out how to rebuild that part of the chromosome. because there are a lot of funny disease processes that males are much more, can inherit much more easily than females. Okay, like hemophilia and color blindness and other kinds of things because of missing that missing chromosome right there. Yeah. Okay, so that's some background. I do want to show you the testes. I think this is it right here. Oh yeah. Okay, which part of the diagram? Right here. Seminiferous tubule. All right, so we're looking at a cross section through the testes, and here is the tube that's producing sperm by spermatogenesis. So this is the seminiferous tubule. And I can see some spermatocytes over here, right? And eventually they'll move into the lumen and then into the straight tubules, eventually into the epididymis. There are some important cells that I want you to know about. Okay? And so here is a cell. It's a somatic cell because it has two copies of chromosomes, and eventually it's going to produce a sperm. Okay, and if it's going to be producing a sperm as opposed to just a regular parent cell that produces two identical cells, if it's going to produce a sperm, this is what we call a germ cell. All right, so that's a germ cell. And those are in these areas up over here. Oh, let me show you maybe, where is it at? Okay, so here is a spermatogonium. This will eventually turn into a sperm. All right, in your book it calls it a stem cell. All right, probably a better term is a germ cell. A germ cell produces a sex cell or a gamete. All right, then there are some other cells. All right, sustentacular cells or Sertoli cells right here that help nourish these maturing sperm cells. All right, so Sertoli cells or sustentacular cells, all right, help nourish the sperm as it's developing. So there's two kinds of cells. One that can make sperm and the other kind that support that process. All right, so that is production of sperm. But what are the two functions of the testes? One is to produce sperm, and what's the other? It's a production. It has to produce something. So sperm is the cell that the testes produces, but there's something else. Testosterone, hormones. Okay? So you should know the names of the cells that produce testosterone. All right, so here's that seminiferous tubule that contains the germ cells and Sertoli cells. And here is a part of some tissue that's outside all seminiferous tubules. All right, so this is just some connective tissue. And I see some interstitial cells. These are not inside of a tubule. They're between the tubule. So here is another tubule here. Here's another tubule here. Here's a tubule. So here is an interstitial cell. These are the cells that produce testosterone. And so sometimes these are called cells of Leydig. All right, interstitial cells or cells of Leydig produce testosterone. So, yeah, Leydig. L-E-Y-D-I-G. All right, so there are three cells that you should know what their function is. The germ cells, which some people call stem cells, which maybe is a little bit of a misnomer. They're really germ cells. These are what are going to produce gametes, right? And what's the name of a male gamete again? Sperm. And what's the name of the process that produces a sperm? That is, no, fertilization makes a zygote. What's the name of the process that makes a male gamete or a sperm? Meiosis. Yeah, meiosis. Meiosis. And how many rounds of cell division does meiosis have? It's got two instead of one, like mitosis. That's why it ends up with half the chromosomes, right? That ends up with that sperm cell. So in the seminiferous tubule, there are Sertoli cells that make nutrients for spermatogenesis, and there are germ cells that actually undergo meiosis to produce sperm. Now, in the cells that are outside the seminiferous tubules, what kind of cells are there? And what do they produce? Germ and Sertoli are inside the seminiferous tubule, right? And that they produce sperm, but what about outside the seminiferous tubule? Interstitial cells. And what do they produce? Testosterone. So they produce that hormone, right? So I do want you to be able to think about those three kinds of cells and where they're located. Like an interstitial cell or a cell of Leydig, where is it located? Inside or outside seminiferous tubule? It's outside the seminiferous tubule. What about a germ cell? Where are they located? Inside. What about a Sertoli cell? Inside. Yeah, so that's how I want you to think about those. Okay, so that's pretty good for knowing the male reproductive system. Okay, so we're going to go on to female reproductive system. Okay, the primary reproductive structure in the female is an ovary. All right, so here is an ovary right here. So we're going to look at a coronal view. Right, we also have a sagittal view that's an important exam figure. And just like the testes, what's the function of an ovary? It's got two functions, but it's a little bit different. It produces gametes, right? And so what do we call that gamete that's produced by an ovary? An egg or oocyte. What's the ploidy of an egg? It's haploid. It has half the number of chromosomes, right? Because with fertilization, you get back to the normal number. That's important. All right, so that's one job of an ovary. What's another job of an ovary besides producing gametes? Hormones. Okay, now this ovary right here doesn't produce testosterone. Okay, it produces the female counterpart to that, which is estrogen. But it also produces a second hormone that males don't have any analog to, and that is called progesterone. So the ovary produces estrogen and progesterone depending on the time of the cycle. And we're going to look at two cycles. There's an ovarian cycle and there's a uterine cycle, and they correlate with each other because of hormones that control these two different cycles. All right, so this is the primary reproductive structure. A cycle lasts for about 28 days, and once during that cycle, there is something called a follicle that develops from an immature form into a mature form, and when it reaches maturity right at mid-cycle, it explodes, it lyses, and it releases a female gamete. Right? So this little dot right here is an oocyte that has been ovulated from a mature follicle. And here I can see a mature follicle that hasn't ovulated yet. And this egg is just a part of many hundreds of cells that make up a follicle. All right, so that happens right at mid-cycle. So now you have an oocyte. And this oocyte doesn't have cilia, doesn't have flagella. All right, but it's got to make its way to the uterus right here. How does it find its way to the uterus? And it doesn't have any magnets, doesn't have any motors, right? So it can't be attracted. How does it find its way? Okay. Because there are other cells that have cilia that are beating and sweeping, right? So this egg is just could float around anywhere in the pelvic cavity. It could float up into the abdominal cavity. Could it float up into the thoracic cavity? No. Why not? Because the diaphragm is going to block it. That's right. But the pelvic and abdominal cavity, just part of the peritoneal cavity, can float around anywhere, right? But if these cilia are working and if the fimbria are working, this egg makes its way down through the fallopian tube to the uterus. And the fimbria kind of look like fingers or a lacy, feathery edge that are continuously sweeping over the edge of an ovary and is lined with cilia so that when ovulation takes place, okay, and even if there's a little bit of mild hemorrhage when ovulation happens, right, those red blood cells and ovary make its way down to the uterus right here. Right, so that's the importance of the fallopian tube. It is a ciliated epithelium as well as the epithelium on these fimbria as well. Okay, so we see that this fallopian tube actually reminds me of a musical instrument. What musical instrument does that remind you of? Anybody do the end of chapter questions yet? Got curious and look up that term? It's used clinically a lot. What instrument does that remind you of? Like, let's just say, here's the mouthpiece, and then here's the open end of an instrument. What does that look like? Maybe a clarinet. Yeah, could be a clarinet, but actually remind way back when, right? Yeah, they made trumpets, but they didn't have it all coiled up. They had what? Really long trumpets, right? Way back when somebody saw these things. So it reminded somebody of a trumpet. And the name of a trumpet is called a salpinx, S-A-L-P-I-N-X, okay? And so a salpinx is just another name for the fallopian tube right here, okay? And if for whatever reason, okay, if there's an infection of the fallopian tube, it could cause a blockage or scar tissue in the fallopian tube, which can lead to, what dangerous condition can that lead to? Well, that egg then can't make its way through that blockage, but sperm can maybe swim through there. Okay, and maybe this egg is up in the pelvic, in the abdominal cavity and gets fertilized there. Implantation takes place in mesentery. What do we call that kind of? That's called an ectopic pregnancy, right? All right, or maybe there's a pregnancy that happened, it implants into the fallopian tube proper. Maybe there's a little scar tissue right here and the egg, fertilized egg can't get through here. That's also an ectopic pregnancy. All right, and if there's scar tissue, sometimes this fallopian tube actually fills up with water. All right, and that's easy to see on imaging. That's called a hydrosalpinx, which is what? It's just a fallopian tube that's filled up with water. Okay, and that scar tissue forms not every time, but sometimes when somebody has any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease, right? All right, so a hydrosalpinx is just a fallopian tube filled with water. And so you should know this is a fallopian tube. And you can image what the shape of the lumen of the uterus is right here, right? And what the lumen of this fallopian tube is. And that's done commonly. That picture is called a hysterosalpingogram. That sounds really weird, but what do you know about what's a salpinx again? It's a fallopian tube. So now you know why they call it hystero. It means what? They're imaging the uterus. And salpingogram is that they're also imaging the fallopian tube at the exact same time. Okay, because it reminded somebody of a trumpet. Okay, so infundibulum is the very first part of the fallopian tube. And that leads to a little bit of a swelling right here that's called the ampule, and then there's kind of a constant radius until you get to this narrowing right here, and that's called the isthmus of the fallopian tube. Okay, here is the uterus. Notice that the biggest layer is the myometrium, that's the muscle layer, and then there is an epithelial layer right here, which is kind of complicated, has even some sublayers. That's what we call the endometrium. And then there's a layer on the outside that we call the perimetrium, which is just connective tissue. But the muscle layer is myometrium, and more of the functional layers is this endometrium right here. All right, so all of these structures are held in place by various ligaments, okay, from the uterus. Oh, this is what we call the body of the uterus, sometimes the fundus, the more superior region right here. There's a ligament that goes from the uterus over to the ovary, that's called the ovarian ligament. All right, then there's a round ligament that goes from the body wall to the uterus right here, holding these structures in place. And furthermore, then there is a very broad ligament that holds all of these structures together, including the ovary and the fallopian tube and the uterus, and so we call that the broad ligament. And you can even see there's different designations of the broad ligament. Okay. So you know the layers of the uterus. The most inferior muscle of the uterus right here is very, very strong, right? And it contracts during the whole term of pregnancy, right? During gestation. And we call that the cervix. But there is a canal through the cervix that we call cervical canal. You could probably call that the birth canal too, because the fetus has to move through this canal during parturition. And the entrance to the cervical canal from the uterus is called the internal os. The opening from the vagina right here is called the external os. And the cervix is a dome of tissue, right? And the lateral margins of that dome are called the fornices. And so here, since this is a coronal view, we see two lateral fornices. But if we have a sagittal view, we're going to see what? An anterior fornix and a posterior fornix. But remember what? It's a complete circle that surrounds the whole cervix right here. All right, and lab, we mentioned something kind of interesting about the cervix right here. All right, and it had to do with whether or not cancer could be considered a sexually transmitted disease. All right, so who says yes, who says no? Who says yes? A few people. Who says no? Okay. Ah, maybe we didn't talk about it. Well, cervical cancer, most forms of it, we know some other reasons why cervical cancer develops, and about 7,000 women die of cervical cancer just in the United States every year. Right? Most forms of cervical cancer are due to an infection of a virus called human papillomavirus. And the only way to get that virus is through intimate sexual contact. Okay? And when those viruses infect the cells of a cervix, it might take 10 or 20 years, we're still not really sure, but they start to turn cancerous over a long period of time and produces cancer of the cervix right here. Okay, due to human papillomavirus. There are way over 104 different varieties of human papillomavirus that we know right now, and we think that four of those, over 100 different varieties, will eventually cause cervical cancer. All right, so I would say, sure, sexually transmitted disease can cause cervical cancer. All right, otherwise, pharmaceutical companies never would have spent all that money developing a vaccine to protect you against cervical cancer. All right, you usually have vaccines to protect you from infections, right? And this particular vaccine protects you from the human papillomavirus in particular, at least the important strains that cause cervical cancer. Anybody know the name of that vaccine? Is it Gardia? Gardasil, that's it, Gardasil, that's it, Gardasil. If somebody has cancer already, then that vaccine hasn't shown any efficacy. It probably will not work. Oh, that's right. It won't protect against transmission either. That's right. It will only protect somebody that hasn't been exposed to the virus before, right? Okay, and don't forget that it takes years, decades maybe, for that to develop. So that's really a shame that all these women are dying in the United States and, all, of course, all over the world, because you have decades to detect it, right? And you can detect it with a very simple pap smear, and if it's detected early, it's 100% treatable and curable. And that's really a marvelous kind of cancer to have, right? If you have a cancer that can be cured, that is wonderful, then it's not like even having cancer, right? Okay, so that says something interesting about the cervix right here. And human papillomavirus, as far as we know, doesn't produce any adverse effects or any kind of symptoms in the male whatsoever. Okay, but we did mention a process in the male that will affect every male if they live long enough. And what was that process called? It had to do with prostate, right? Hypertrophy of the prostate. And human papillomavirus, some forms maybe are implicated in that disease process, but that still is pure speculation. So it might have some important clinical ramifications in the male, but we're not really sure. All right, then. All right, so sperm have to swim up through this external os, through the cervical canal, into the uterus, and indeed out through the fallopian tube. And this is where we believe most fertilization takes place, within the fallopian tube. But don't forget, if that egg can't get into the fallopian tube and is floating around in the abdominal cavity, those sperm can swim right out to the opening of the fallopian tube, right, and fertilize that egg. Okay, they're deposited here in the vagina, so that's one of the functions of the vagina, is to receive sperm for fertilization. All right, but what's another function of the vagina? For parturition or birth, right? So it's another part of the birth canal, just like the cervical canal, right? The fetus has to come down through the vagina as well. All right, so that's some important structures of maybe disease processes and concerns of the uterus, or female reproductive system. So next time we're going to finish up and talk about some of the hormones, because we do have to look at some hormones. So if you want to get prepared for lecture next time, it might be a good idea to look at these following three pictures. All right, they're all included in one. So here are some hormones called LH and FSH. They come from the pituitary gland, anterior pituitary. These control the ovary. So the pituitary controls the ovary. And remember, what part of the brain controls the anterior pituitary? The hypothalamus, really good. So the hypothalamus is telling the anterior pituitary to release these hormones, which then control things inside the ovary. Right? And then, so these are the structures inside the ovary. We have different follicles in different stages of development. And then right at mid-cycle, what did we say happened right at mid-cycle? Remember, the cycle is a 28-day cycle, typically a textbook cycle. Of course, it can vary, but right at mid-cycle, that's when ovulation takes place. All right, and these structures within the ovary release hormones, and those hormones are estrogen and progesterone. All right, so the pituitary releases what? LH and FSH, luteinizing hormone and FSH, while the follicles release two different kinds of hormones, ovarian hormones, estrogen and progesterone. So we're going to look and see how these control different aspects of the female reproductive cycle. Okay, so, I'm sorry, look at these four diagrams. Because the ovarian hormones then control events in the endometrium of the uterus. All right, so it will be really helpful if you look at maybe the different phases of the uterine cycle, different phases of the ovarian cycle, and some hormones that are used to regulate these things and where they come from. Okay, so please sign the sign-in sheet. We've got to go over some female anatomy again next time, but mostly we're going to be talking about hormones next time. All right, so that's it for today. Sign-in sheet is coming down. And my recorder did not turn off. That's nice.